I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 28th of October. Tonight, the Republican presidential candidates will debate once again, and they'll be talking about money issues, the economy, and we thought it would be an appropriate day for us to do the same. Our guest this hour has said that America doesn't just need a raise, we need a new national norm for wage growth. What are the causes of wage stagnation? What policies do we need to address the causes in ways that are consistent with today's economy and workforce? Joining us this hour is Professor Thomas Kohan. He's professor of management at MIT's Sloan School of Management, and he has a PhD in industrial relations from the University of Wisconsin. He's also taught at Cornell, and he was a consultant for 1 year to the Secretary of Labor in the Department of Labor's Office of Policy Evaluation and Research. We'll be welcoming phone calls for the professor, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Thomas Kohan, thanks very much for joining us once again on the show. Hello.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
It's good to be back with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. You write that from roughly the end of World War II through much of the 1970s, the real cost of living adjusted wages increased in tandem with gains in productivity. And then something changed long about 1980. What changed?
Well, there were three things that really came together. First, we had a shift from Democratic to a very conservative Republican with Ronald Reagan's election. And secondly, we went into a very deep recession induced by the Federal Reserve Board to break the back of the terrible inflation we had in the 1970s. And that drove up the value of the dollar, and it really shifted bargaining power in collective bargaining. And at the same time, we saw a flood of new manufacturing imports, particularly from Japan, high-quality automobiles, steel, products that were being built at more productive, at higher productivity than we could in the United States. And so the balance of power shifted, and management became much more militant in asking for wage concessions and in opposing unionization much more strongly. And that has carried on ever since.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about unionization for a moment, because you also say that the decline in unions accounts for, and this is significant, as much as 20 to 30% of the rise in wage inequality. That's huge.
That's an enormous amount. And the people who look at these figures have only really come to grips with the size of the impact of union decline in the last few years. And now I think it's generally accepted that the decline in unions has cost the economy and cost our society an enormous amount in terms of wage growth, social equity, and the ability of workers to have some influence over the future of not only their jobs, but of the course of this country.
Considering how dramatic the gap is between those who have and those who have not in this country, why are you pessimistic about unions not likely to be rebounding soon?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is that the law governing union organizing is so badly broken that it is very, very difficult for workers who want to join a union to get access to a union and collective bargaining. The penalties are too weak. The enforcement powers are slow, and it's very rational in some ways for an employer to resist and to resist successfully. So gaining access to collective bargaining through the traditional mechanisms built into our law is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But the second reason, and maybe even more important, is that the economy has changed dramatically. And so we now have a much more globally competitive economy. We have to worry about competing with countries with much lower wages. So the traditional practices to take wages out of competition through collective bargaining simply are not going to be adequate in the future, and they're not going to result in improvements in wages in the same way as they did in the past. And the strike has lost its effectiveness in many settings because there are too many non-union alternatives to the unionized workforce. And so for all these reasons, we've got to bring new forms of worker voice and new forms of bargaining power to workers that fit today's economy and that don't depend on just the old practices.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to those new forms in just a moment. A lot of communities, not a lot, but a significant number of communities have been raising the national, raising the minimum wage in their communities, Seattle notably recently, and it seems to be working well for them at $15 an hour. Raising the national minimum, as the president has suggested, to $10.10 an hour, would you suggest restore purchasing power for those who are at the bottom of the wage distribution? Would it restore it significantly? Is that a good figure, or do we need more than that? Can we do with less than that?
I don't think we can do with less than that. It's a good starting figure. My suggestion would be, along with many other people making the same proposal, that we index the minimum wage to some indicator of economic growth. That could be increases in the average wage across the economy. That could be increases in the cost of living. That could be increases in the cost of living and productivity, which is the old wage norm that we had. But $10.10 an hour would be an improvement. I think one could go a little bit higher than that, even in the next 2 years or so, to $12 an hour without really having to worry too much about losing jobs because wages get too high for minimum wage workers. I don't think we can go to $15 an hour all at once. That's just not realistic. And that's too big of a shock for employers to absorb and for customers to absorb. So I think we have to do this gradually, but we have to do it steadily over time, not just every 3, 5, 10 years when the politics finally get aligned.
Is this movement by cities expanding or not? Is it just a few cities?
Oh, no, it's been growing. You know, Seattle was one of the early movers, but Los Angeles, San Francisco, cities around the country are acting, and so are states. Massachusetts and a number of other states have increased wages. So we now have over 20 states that have minimum wages higher than the national minimum, which is $7.25 an hour. So we're seeing local and state governments take responsible action. They tend to all do it gradually. Relatively few are going to the $15 an hour level, and those that are spacing that over time, so it isn't such a big shock on the system all at once.
The Democratic candidates for president have made inequality a major issue in their debates so far. The Republicans are again debating tonight. Do you hear a great deal of talk and some possible solutions among the Republicans to take on inequality in wage, in wealth?
Well, the good news is that every politician has to talk about it today, and they are talking about it, from the conservative Republicans to the liberal Democrats. And that really is the first step in making progress. We've got to get this on the national agenda, and we've got to give people some hope that we can actually do something about it. And so the Republicans are talking in their own ways about increasing opportunity. Some are even talking about increasing taxes on the wealthy, which is quite radical for a Republican candidate. Whether that's going to carry the day or not remains to be seen. Others are talking about increases in the minimum wage, but they do that very, very cautiously and gingerly because they know that that's not a particularly attractive issue for many of their constituents. And I think they're beginning to say that we have to find ways to make sure that corporations are doing their share and to make sure that we are helping the middle income, the middle range workers and their families. And so that's all great. I'm going to listen quite closely tonight to see if they become more concrete in what they would do. So far, it's quite vague, but I suspect it will be part of the conversation, and that's all to the good.
And why would it be at all controversial when we look at what the gap is and how much money the very, very wealthy in this country are making? Why is it controversial to suggest, let alone enact, increased taxes for that group? They can afford to pay it.
Well, it's controversial if you really believe that the way to generate economic growth and improvements in family income is by simply unleashing the wealthy to reinvest and to create jobs and to spend incomes and so on. But that view of the economy is been shown to be so out of sync with the facts that almost no one believes it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yet people cling to it, and they cling to the notion that we pay too much in taxes and it's all government regulations. Well, it's time for people to call the question on that. That's why you're seeing Republicans beginning to talk about it, because that argument doesn't sell anymore to the American public, and they have to come up with something more concrete. They don't have a clear agenda yet because it's really foreign territory for their ideology and for the people who are funding their campaigns. And so they have a real dilemma. How do they speak to the American public, at the same time not deviate too far from the people who are behind their fundraising? So that's their problem at the moment, and that's what I'll be interested in hearing how they address it tonight.
Aren't some of the same people funding Democratic candidates as well?
Yes, some are. And I think for the Democratic candidates, the challenge is how do they really address the role that Wall Street has played in this field. Because Wall Street is part of the problem. This emphasis on short-term profit maximization or shareholder value, boosting up the stock prices, whatever one has to do, at the expense of long-term investment in the business and growing the business and paying a decent wage and competing on the basis of good wages and good productivity. That's all part of the pressures that CEOs feel from Wall Street and have felt since the 1980s. And we've got to address that issue squarely in the next administration. And that will take courage, because many of the Wall Street business leaders are also supporters of the Democratic Party. And mm-hmm. we can't back away from addressing this issue just because of their support for particular candidates.
Our guest this hour is Professor Thomas Cohan. He's professor of management at MIT's Sloan School of Management, has joined us before to talk about wage stagnation and what it is that we need to do in this country to look at the ways to get rid of wage stagnation, to make the economy more fair for all. We have to look at the reasons for the causes of wage stagnation, and because it is so much a part of presidential campaign rhetoric, and the Republicans are speaking on economic issues this evening. The Democrats certainly have done so in their debate. We thought it might be a good day for us to take on this very issue. And we welcome your phone calls. Excuse me. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We've talked, and our guest has outlined in a recent piece what we thought would be a remedy if you have increased education. Is that a remedy for wage inequality? Does it make a big difference? What about the number of manufacturers manufacturing jobs that have left this country. We've heard that some of those jobs are coming back to the United States. How many of those jobs are coming back? Is that a big thing that's happening right now? Minimum wage. Some cities have minimum wage. Would we be able to increase significantly the purchasing power of those who make the least in this country if we raise the wage to what? What do you think would be good? And we will get to this when he talked about unions accounting for as much as 20-30% of the rise in wage inequality. What would work? Collective bargaining, the old form, he says, probably would not work as well in today's global economy. So what would work? Our phone number, 800-486-8655, and we'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our lines are filled. Let's go right to your phone calls, and we start with Pat. And hi, Pat, where are you calling from?
Nasita.
Hi, Pat. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
You know, I understand the need. I have a son that is a waiter and living on that with no benefits, and I understand, you know, there's certainly a need for you know, having the ability to live a better life, or, you know, get into the middle class. I'm just not sure that raising the minimum wage is the answer. I can't understand why, you know, we're not striving, making it more beneficial for communities, states, to produce jobs that have better wages, and maybe offer programs where people can have access to training that will get them in a job that possibly pays better. I mean, I have a son that's in college, and he works at McDonald's right now, and I certainly don't expect McDonald's to pay $15 an hour. It just doesn't seem reasonable. I would think that, you know, minimum wage for his type of situation is fine, but I think that getting jobs to our communities and in our state that pay better in them themselves would be a better answer.
Professor Colhoun?
Well, I agree with Pat that the preferred option is to produce more jobs that are well above the minimum wage, and we have to work at that. And education and training are a necessary condition for gaining access to those jobs, but we also have to start to invest. We have to invest in the two things that have the best rate of return for job creation and for economic growth in the long run. The first is infrastructure. We all know just by driving and by using our telephones and using all the modern modes of communication that we're way behind other countries. And we have one professional society of civil engineers says we have a $3 trillion need for investment in infrastructure. That, you know, we could generate between now and the end of this decade, between 4 and 5 million new good-paying jobs, that is, engineering jobs, construction jobs, manufacturing of materials that would support this, and good service and consulting and business service jobs. That's where we need to go first to really get the kind of quality of employment that Americans need and expect. Education is the second one. Clearly, we're just getting now the national numbers again on student achievement, and they're a bit disappointing, even given all of the reforms that have been put in place and the innovations that are underway in many states around the country. And so we've got so much more to do on early childhood education, to making college more affordable, to technical schools that will train the next generation of technicians, manufacturing, skilled workers that are able to deal with new technologies. That's where we need to be investing and making sure that we have those jobs. But one way that we can help is by increasing the minimum wage, as I said, gradually, but steadily, because that then encourages firms to invest in new technologies, in more high productivity work practices, to make their workers more productive, to pay for those higher wages. That's the historical trajectory that has helped people at the bottom achieve a living wage, and then those at higher levels get ratcheted up on the basis of increases in the minimum. So some combination of minimum wage, but many other things that Pat was emphasizing are needed.
You say that we need to expand the number of college graduates who have advanced science, technical, math, and problem-solving skills. I would imagine those kinds of jobs are in high demand and pay pretty well. Are there enough people to fill them?
I was just at a session in Washington where the Siemens Foundation, funded by the Siemens Corporation, this large manufacturing firm that's a German firm but has about 50 or so factories in the United States, supports. And the discussion was, how can we create more employer consortia, employers working together to fund these technical skills and STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math educational programs, both in technical schools, community colleges, and four-year universities. There's no question that those jobs pay well above the median wage in the United States. The estimates will range from different parts of the country from $50,000 to $70,000 a year or more. Mm-hmm. Those are very good jobs, good starting jobs, and if one keeps their skills current, will provide long-term and prosperous careers. So we need to invest more in that area. But that requires industry working with education, industry working with labor for apprenticeships and rebuilding our apprenticeships and helping to think through what are the changing needs of industry and how do we work together to make sure we've got enough workers. I don't think we have a skill shortage. I think we have a training shortage. And that was actually what the CEO of Siemens said at this little conference in Washington. I was delighted to see him say that because he recognizes that industry isn't doing enough to train the people that are out there capable of doing this work but haven't had the opportunity to pick up some of these skills. There's no shortage of talent. There's a shortage of training.
Thanks, Pat, for your call. We go next to Ira in Poinette. Hi, Ira.
Hello. You mentioned indexing minimum wage to something like cost of living. Just wondering if you have comments about an accurate cost of living index. We keep hearing that our cost of living to average people has not gone up, but most people I know feel the opposite is true. So I just want to see if you have any comment.
Yes, the Ira's raising a point that we hear very often. The standard measure is put out by the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the federal government. It's based on the changes in the cost of what they call a typical market basket of goods. And that's been done the same way with some modest adjustments for changes in the economy and so on for the last 40 years or so. And it's called the Urban and Regional Consumer Price Index. And you can get it for cities and regions, and you can get it nationally. It's a good measure, but it does often miss things. So, for example, the price of gas and oil has gone down now. So that's going to have a significant effect on consumer prices. But at the same time, the price of food, the price of housing, the price of education have gone up considerably. And some of those prices are a little bit harder to capture because not everybody is investing in college education. Certainly everybody is buying food, but the differential cost of meat, for example, to restaurants and fish to restaurants is often lost in some of these calculations. So it's not a perfect measure, but it's the best we have. The economists at the Labor Department continue to work to try to improve it, and I think we have to go with it the best way we as the best measure that's available right now.
Another question on cost of living. Joan in Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Hi.
I appreciate everything that has been said until now. In my market basket, food is a big deal. I'm 83 years old. I don't need a college education anymore, but I live month to month, and the place where I go out for a breakfast once a month when I get my pension check has raised their breakfast from $2.99 to $3.99 because of the cost of eggs. Now, you tell me how I can influence our federal government to take better care of our 83-year-olds, or are we on the garbage heap of society?
Well, Joan raises a really important point, and I fully understand people who are on fixed incomes and live from month to month for the Social Security or, if they're fortunate, a pension check. And we've all had parents or have parents or are entering that stage of life, so we see it, we feel it, and we don't have a good answer for Joan. We have to value people who have contributed to our economy for so many years. They deserve our respect, and they deserve a decent and comfortable income. We do increase the Social Security pension by the cost of living, but because the cost of living hasn't gone up much at all this year, there won't be an increase in those rates this year. So while Joan is experiencing increased cost of food, she won't see it in her Social Security check. And that's creates more hardship for people. I wish I had an answer to that. I'm not only worried about Joan and her age group, but I'm particularly worried about those people who have lost their private pensions over the years and are about to retire, because they've lost an enormous amount of value, either in losing their pension or in declines of their 401k or the lack of either.
Mm-hmm. How many people have lost their pensions? Is it a large number?
Oh, we at one point had about just under 50% of the workforce had a defined benefit pension plan. We're now down to 20%. And most of those that still have one are public employees. The private industry has gotten rid of the standard defined benefit pension plan, and many big companies have replaced them with these 401ks or other form of what's called defined contribution. There are two problems with that. One is that they don't replace the value of the pensions that we once had, and secondly, they shift the risk of those pensions onto the employees, mm-hmm. so that instead of having a formula based on one's average earnings or whatever and years of service that produces a standard monthly rate, you get whatever the stock market has produced at the time you retire. So if you were unfortunate enough to want to retire during the Great Recession of 2007 and 2009, you lost a big chunk of your mm-hmm. pension.
Yeah.
It's coming back now, but who knows which way the economy is
going
to go.
It can be very precarious. Yeah.
Yeah.
Joan, thank you. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
You know, what we have a shortage of in this country is people who fail to love, respect, and promote trade unions, as your guest has failed to do so. Evoking Siemens, a company that took 42,000 jobs out of the state of Wisconsin, unionized jobs from the 1980s through the aughts. The loss of income isn't 20% responsible because of the loss of labor union power. It's close to 85 to 90%. And those statistics come from the national AFL-CIO. And until we get every single one of our lost industrial jobs back here so that we start making things again, we are just spinning our wheels, and we are going to have a civil society that produces 200 homicides a year, as we are doing here in the city of Milwaukee.
Professor Cohen.
Well, Jim, I am a strong, strong believer in the value of unions, and I have worked on labor management relations and improving the quality of labor management relations all my career, so I share your concern. But the reality is we've got to bring unions back in ways that are able to give workers real bargaining power. And yes, collective bargaining can do that in some settings. We just saw a good example of that in the auto industry, where the Chrysler agreement with the Auto Workers Union and the General Motors agreement, which is, I think, being discussed with members today, are very good agreements. But these are unions that still have big companies that are now doing well, and they can get back on the road to improving wages as they have in this recent contract negotiations. But that's the exception. So we've got to organize the new manufacturing jobs, but we've got to do it in a way that says as the UAW in some ways has done. Let's talk about profit sharing. Let's make sure that as the companies prosper, we prosper. Let's find new ways to represent workers, as the UAW tried to do with a works council at Volkswagen. Let's make sure that we stay with workers as they move across jobs, whether they have collective bargaining rights or not as union members, as the building trades do. So there are new ways to organize workers, to represent workers. Let's use the regional coalitions that Seattle and the service employees used in Seattle to get the business community to the bargaining table with the politicians to get the $15 an hour minimum wage over several years. Those are the new forms of worker voice and representation that supplement the traditional forms of collective bargaining that might get our economy and our wages moving in the right direction. So, yes, we need new forms of worker voice. We have to replace the unions that have been declining, but we also have to think about new ways to do all of that.
Let's talk a little bit. You've written about this government contracted businesses requiring those people to disclose their wage and hour compliance records, and also giving priority in awarding contracts to firms that pay above average wages. Is that happening now? Was there an executive order on that?
There's an executive order for companies to disclose their compliance with wage and hour and discrimination and other safety and health rules and regulations. That's still working its way through the rulemaking process. President Obama signed that executive order about a year ago. They hope to get it in place sometime in 2016, and that would be a first step. We should make transparent which companies are violating the law, and then which companies are more responsible employers, and make sure that that information gets out to the American public so they can make better choices as consumers and also put pressure on these companies as workers. The second part, though, we haven't done yet, and that is we should be rewarding those companies that pay well, and we should be insisting that if we're going to buy goods and services as a government from companies in the United States, that they not only meet our expectations for paying good wages, but that they have other practices that make sure that this is high productivity, good training opportunities and learning and development programs are in place in their companies so that they can afford to pay those high wages. So this isn't a subsidy, or this isn't an uncompetitive kind of argument. This is an argument that we can be a high wage, a high productivity economy if we invest in skills and we invest in our workforce and have modern work practices. Then we can afford to pay workers better, and we should be pushing those norms through our government contracting process.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Lynn writes on Facebook, I have a doctorate. I'm 61 years old. There are only minimum wage jobs available to me, so I stay home and make applesauce. There are no jobs. My doctorate is in educational leadership. I did teach elementary and preschool, but it only pays $13 an hour. You want all this education to work with your children, but you don't want to pay for it.
Well, she's right. There's nothing to argue with her reality, and her reality is matched by many other underemployed people. That's the term that we like to use for that predicament. We have 40% or so of college graduates coming out today are still underemployed. They're not utilizing their skills. We've got to help to get our educators and our human service providers the kinds of jobs that allow them to not only use their skills, but pay them a decent living wage commensurate with their education. So that's why I think investment in education is so important. And working with the populations, whether it's home health care aides or licensed practical nurses working out in the community, or special education professionals, or English language professionals, there's a need. There's a tremendous number of people who need tutoring and skills in these areas. We just have to start investing in ways that put these talents to work.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Thomas Cohan. He's a professor of management at MIT's Sloan School of Management. And we're looking at why it is that we have experienced many decades now of wage stagnation and rising income inequality, and what can we do about it. That's the gist of what we're discussing this hour. We have a couple lines open. We've been crowded, but you can get through now. 800-486-8655 is our number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls. Karen in Madison is next. Hello, Karen.
Hi. I'd like to comment on the radical shift in emotional and intellectual acceptance of the American public to being taxed. In the 50s, we were paying off the war, but we also were putting in the national highway system. We were, you know, building the country up. And my parents were upper middle income, but they paid 75% of their income to taxes for at least 10 years, and they never complained. They said, we're getting roads and bridges. You're having a fantastic education. We have a great university. What's to complain about? But then when Ronald Reagan was elected, they had a big shift and called him the best thing that ever happened to this country. And they didn't know that their daughter was about to become chronically ill, and I've spent my whole adulthood as a disabled person seeing my benefits go down and down and down until I experienced the same condition the previous caller did. I can't buy food. My friends buy food for me. Money is a constant source of stress. And, you know, President Obama gave a lot of things to Republicans in exchange for like a 20% cut in benefits to people like me, and then the Republicans didn't give him what they promised. So my thing is that people are so incensed about a $4 raise in their taxes that in Wisconsin, they're abolishing AP credits for $4 a year on people's taxes. And what bothers me is people have changed their minds about supporting their neighbor's kid to go to school. It was okay if your neighbor paid for your kid to go to school, but 10 years later, they don't want any taxes. And it's really affected people like me and education, and I just don't know when we're going to turn around and get to the idea that being on a bridge that falls down is not worth like $30 a year in your taxes.
Professor Cohan.
Well, I think Karen and colleagues need to get out there and just take what she said to the politicians who are running for office. In Wisconsin, you've got a Senate election coming up. Eventually, you'll have another governor's election. You have a presidential election like we all will next year. And this is exactly what the politicians need to hear, that there are people who are desperate out there and people who are fed up with the lack of an equitable tax system. And there are, I think, an increasing number of higher income people who, like Karen's parents, would be willing to pay more in taxes. How much more remains to be seen. But it's time to get on with this, because we're not going to solve the problems of this country unless we start to increase taxes on those in the highest levels of income. That's simply a necessary condition.
Would she have been correct in 75% of her parents'
yes.
income? Really?
Yes, if they were in the top tax brackets, that's what it was in the 1960s, 70s. Hmm. Then it started to go down, and then it went down into the 30s. Percentile range in the 1980s and 90s. And with the Bush tax cuts in 2001, that was and 2003 were the last ones that brought us down that low. We raised them just a couple percentage points a few years ago, but we're still in the 30s.
Mm. Karen, thank you for your poignant call. Tim in Green Bay, hi.
Hello, how are you doing?
All right, Tim, how are you?
Real good. I just have a very quick comment, and it goes back to the mindset of what I think a lot of people have. I'm going to go back to the person just discussing that only had a college degree, could only make $13 an hour, and so sat home and made applesauce. So why not get the education in something that will easily pay more? There are employers begging for technically skilled people. Begging. She could easily make 2 to 3 times the money that she was just talking about, but she actually has to get that education and go work rather than sit at home and make applesauce.
Well, to defend her for a moment, her doctorate, she said, is in educational leadership. She did teach school for a while, but she's in her 60s. It would seem to me that a doctorate in educational leadership should be something worthwhile, and you ought to be able to find a job that would pay something, don't you think?
Well, it may have been 40 years ago, but it may not be any longer.
Mm-hmm. What do you say about this, Professor?
Well, there's no question that the social sciences and liberal arts don't pay as much as those with the so-called STEM skills. And so it's very difficult for someone middle age and above to make that transition. We do need to provide more training programs, retraining programs for the workforce. But the best way to do that is to train and retrain people while they are still employed, because that's when they can learn on the job and they can learn new skills and they can make the adjustments to go where the job opportunities are. I would then put an enormous emphasis on doing what Tim said for young people. There's a whole generation of young people who I mentioned earlier who are underemployed, but they have the ability to learn the math and the science and the technical skills through on-the-job learning and maybe online learning, some combinations. That's where industry needs to work with our technical schools, with the great 4-year schools that you have in Wisconsin and with the university, to say let's retrain those people and help people who may not have made the wisest choice of college majors, but have the capacity to learn and to adapt. So industry should stop complaining about skill shortages or lack of qualified people and say, let's work together with our universities and let's put these people to work and let's train them in the new technologies and let's see if we can't make sure that we have the skills that we need. I think there's you have very, very good technical schools in the state of Wisconsin. And all you need to do is to get the employers and the universities and the technical schools working together to fill those training gaps. And I think we would see wages rise, and we would see companies staying in Wisconsin, reinvesting in Wisconsin, and helping to move the economy forward.
Well, what if your talents aren't in the technical area? What if you want to be an English teacher?
Well, I think we have to rebuild the bargaining power of teacher unions. They've been essentially destroyed in the state of Wisconsin with the changes in collective bargaining legislation that the governor imposed a few years ago. And so you haven't seen wages move for teachers in Wisconsin at all in the last decade. If anything, they are more stagnant today than average wages in the economy. So there's no substitute for rebuilding collective bargaining for teachers and for others, and for then investing in education. So not everyone will go into the STEM fields, but I think we have to recognize that there is a wage premium in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Tim, thank you. Steve in Kendall. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could maybe comment on the role of nonprofits in the economy as far as at least providing, you know, some good jobs, maybe not high paying, but jobs that people can build on. And I'd just like to hear the comment. I'll go off the air.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
We have an increasing variety of nonprofit or for-profit companies that call themselves benefit corporations or cooperatives. You have Ocean Spray in Wisconsin Rapids, you know, the big cranberry producer. That's a cooperative organization that certainly has to cover its cost and make a profit, but then redistributes that profit among its employees. You have employee stock ownership programs in a variety of places. You have fantastic organizations like that in, for example, a company I know in Ocana Falls, Ocano, Team Industries, good friends of mine who have been very successful in building a for-profit but partly employee-owned organization that has fed a lot of good money back to the workforce and into the community and has trained lots of people and worked cooperatively with its unions. So there are a variety of organizations, both profit-making and nonprofit, that have created good jobs and can create career profiles. There are foundations in Milwaukee and Madison that have been funded by some of the old-line corporations that invest in early childhood education, provide good jobs for professionals. So we need a variety of for-profit and nonprofit organizations to get wages and the economy moving in the right direction.
Terry sent this email. Education won't completely solve the problem. Somebody has to flip the burgers. Someone has to take care of the children. It's hard work. Why is it okay for people to work full-time and hard and still be poor?
Well, that's why we need living wage, minimum wage legislation at the state level and at the national level, and why we need living wage programs. Some cities have adopted living wage ordinances. I know Milwaukee has been active in that area, and that's a way of saying that there has to be a very basic social minimum. You know, this is deep in our moral fabric and in our religious traditions in the United States. The concept of a living wage came from a Catholic priest at the in the early 1900s, Father John Ryan, who basically said, going back and looking at the various papal encyclicals and doctrines, that we stand firmly for a living wage, for that all work is has dignity, and we should have some minimums that allow people to support their family and to be able to encourage their children to move on and get the kind of education and have the stable family settings that they need in order to be prosperous down the road. That's so deep in our moral values that we need to stand up for them and start talking about them again and enforcing them in our political process and start voting on the basis of our moral values, our values for work, and start voting our economic interests rather than get sidetracked on a whole bunch of other issues that seem to be talked about rather than the economic issues.
Professor Kohan, a pleasure to speak with you again. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's always a pleasure.
Professor Thomas Kohan, he's professor of management at MIT's Sloan School of Management and co-director of the MIT Workplace Center and the Institute for Work and Employment Research. He got his PhD at UW-Madison in industrial relations. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the program, and Scotty as well for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be back.